You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures is a new book by Robert K. Whitman. Robert is described as the Wall Street, by the Wall Street Journal, as a legend. The Times in London called him the most famous art detective in the world. Rising from humble roots as the son of an antique dealer, Whitman built a 20-year career that was nothing short of extraordinary. He went undercover, usually unarmed, to catch art thieves, scammers and black market traders in Paris and Philadelphia, Rio and Santa Fe, Miami and Madrid. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from Philadelphia, Robert Whitman himself. Robert, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Hi, Giles. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. The art market has come on in the past 30, 40 years to be seen as an investment. It's... countries are proud of their artists. They promote them in all their national tourism campaigns. It is a great thing, a great mark of culture to have a modern piece of art on your wall. It says so much about an institution or a person. And there's a market for that. And when there is a market and there are finite resources, you will find the criminal underbelly. Explain how you came to get involved with tracking down the bad guys in the art world.
Well, you have to understand, and your listeners have to understand, that when it comes to art, it's just a commodity for criminals. And in today's world, the fact is it's a $200 billion industry worldwide, art and collectibles. And, at the FBI, when I was there, we talked about cultural heritage protection. And that also talked about things like collectibles like comic books, which are selling for millions of dollars today. Even a Tom Brady rookie football card from the year 2000 recently sold for $1.3 million. So these things are now all part of the cultural heritage of the world. And they're all part considered as high value assets that can be monetized and stolen by thieves. And it's also created a huge fraud market involving fakes and forgeries. So all of that is part of the art criminal industry, which is estimated to be at about $6 billion a year around the world. Estimations come from a study we did in the early 2000s, we being the FBI, working with Interpol, with the Art and Antique Squad in London. We came up with that figure, and it's probably higher today because of the value of artwork that's out there. There's the latest, greatest painting that sold was a Da Vinci for over $400 million. So when things like that are happening, it creates a atmosphere, a place for criminals to go.
We're all familiar with those pictures on our TV screens when a Van Gogh goes for sale, when a Da Vinci goes for sale and sells for a huge amount of money. And it's always, it's a Christie's, a Sotheby's, it's a New York, it's a London auction room. There are anonymous telephone bidders. It seems to, A, be in a world rarefied from what most of us will experience, but B, the very nature, because people don't want to actually say, hey, look at me, I just bought a $400 million painting. They want to be discreet about it. And I suppose in that discretion, in that sort of covert way of bidding and working, that also leads itself open to abuse, because that's the sort of those are sort of areas that criminals, individuals and gangs would like to work in.
Well, the thing is with that, when we're talking about collectors that are paying enormous sums of money for artworks, they have a different mindset. That's a different group of individuals from the criminals. Of course, the criminals are just trying to make a profit. That's all they're interested in, and with no investment. If you steal a painting and you sell it, it's all profit. There was no cost basis to buy that painting. Now, when you talk about collectors, that group, there's different mindsets. So there's some collectors who are very, very interested in these things. They love the types of paintings, the types of collectibles they're buying, and they have the heart of a collector. Then you have these people who are treasure hunters, who basically, have made a little bit of money and they think that they could turn a profit on something. So they're willing to do it legally and they buy these materials. And then I think the third group that I've come across have been individuals who buy it for status. There's people who want to own these things. There's not a real Jackson Pollock painting in any museum in Florida. And so, individuals in Florida love Jackson Pollock. Believe it or not, I had a case where an individual called me, and he had 25 Jackson Pollock paintings. And he was in Washington, D.C. Now, think about this. 25 Jackson Pollocks. He paid about $12,000 for all 25. He bought them on the Internet from a dealer in South Florida. So he called my company, and he asked us to go see if we could do an investigation to find out where these came from and you know, if they were very valuable. If they were, they were probably worth $500 million, $500 million, because there's 25 of them. So we went. We found the seller. She lived in she worked out of a flea market in South Florida, near Orlando, and actually in Fort Lauderdale, I'm sorry. And she was working out of a Harley-Davidson dealership. And when we interviewed her, we said, well, where do you get all these Jackson Pollocks? And she said, they're not Jackson Pollocks. I mean, even though they're signed that, it's just a name. And we get them from overseas, and we sell them for a couple $1,000s on the Internet. And she told me, because everybody wants a Jackson Pollock on their wall in Florida, and they don't care if it's real or not. So these are not Jackson. These are drip paintings that are in the style of a Jackson Pollock. But it's amazing because, you know, everybody, this status thing is out there and everybody wants one.
And especially with the Pollock, that would be so easy to do a facsimile of. We're talking art, but we're also talking about, the book is called as we know, Priceless. And it's not just something you can hang on the wall. I mean, you've also looked at things like, was it the Civil War flag that was taken in by an African-American regiment? Am I correct in that one?
Yeah, that was a battle flag that was carried by the 12th Regiment Corps d'Afrique, actually into battle at the Battle of Port Hudson in the early Civil War. And my understanding is five individuals who were color bearers carried that flag and were shot out from under it. And that was one of the first times in history when African Americans were fighting for their freedom and for the freedom of all their generations to come. Now, that flag was being sold. It was stolen from the U.S. Army in the early 1970s. It was being sold for about $35,000. So it wasn't the most valuable financial flag. But in this case, because of the history and the background and what it represented, it was one of the most important pieces we ever recovered, because it did represent the freedom of human beings, you know, coming out of slavery and fighting for their freedom forever. You know, it's reminiscent of what's happening in the Ukraine today, where people are fighting for freedom and democracy. And it's the same type of situation. More people are being killed there as well. But this particular piece was very important to me and for our recovery. Now, I recovered other pieces worth $100 million. All right. I mean, we recovered an original copy of the United States Bill of Rights, one of the 13 originals sent out by George Washington to be ratified by the states at that time in 1787. And one of those was stolen during the Civil War. We recovered North Carolina's copy. That was valued at $100 million. But you see, both are important. One's more financially valuable, but they're both equally important for history and for cultural heritage.
When we think about art crime and art criminals, we think of, you know, gangs of guys in balaclavas, you know, abseiling through the skylight, you know, doing that whole Sean Connery, Catherine Zeta-Jones entrapment, whatever that one with the film was, and making off a highly planned organization, you know, thought out with a team behind it. But it, again, because the nature of art is so different, it's not always the criminal gangs again. Sometimes it can be some guy who wants to make a few more bucks on the side. I believe there was it George, somebody's hair, George Washington's hair, Thomas Jefferson's hair, somebody's hair, wasn't it? Obtained, shall we say?
Yeah, I had a case involving historical artifacts that were stolen from the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. And one of the pieces, there was more than 200 pieces taken worth about $2.5 million. One of the pieces was a signet ring that had a piece of George Washington's hair in it and was carried by a young lieutenant in the Marines in the 1815s. So it was in the early 1800s. He had it in the Barber Wars. He actually was in the Barber Wars in Tripoli, and he wore that ring with George Washington's locket of his hair. So yeah, those things become very interesting and very valuable as well. Interestingly enough, one of the biggest cases I ever did was in Spain. It was in Madrid. I was the undercover operator working to recover the stolen paintings that were taken from the Koplowitz family in Madrid. We recovered about $65 million worth of paintings in that case. In fact, upon meeting the criminals in I think it was the Hotel Melilla in Madrid, we were able to recover a Bruegel at that moment, plus the swing by Goya, which at that time was valued in the $15 million range. So interestingly enough, one of the biggest cases I ever did was in Spain and working with the Spanish National Police.
I love the idea of somebody just coming along just with a Bruegel, you know, in the briefcase. You know, just a small thing I've got with me. Working undercover, presumably that involves, this is a situation where you're coming face to face with, you know, people who are carrying out a crime worth millions of dollars. There is an element of danger in that. I mean, it's not all people are going to put their hands in their ears. Okay, you know, as we'd say in the UK, it's a fair cop, gov, or whatever the Spanish equivalent of that is, or the American equivalent of that is. Because, you know, we could say, you said it's just for profit, but that profit, when criminals operate, presumably they can use that profit to finance other cases or other crimes that perhaps aren't so... Somebody might argue that an art crime is almost a romantic, is a throwback crime, but presumably with the proceeds of that crime, you could go to finance any other operation, be it drugs, be it terrorism, be it some pretty unsavory activities.
Well, you have to remember, you know, what we called art crime at the FBI was a gateway crime. So, generally speaking, these gangs that we went up against that we would break up by these art theft investigations and convictions were doing many things. I mean, they weren't just stealing a painting. They were doing armed robberies. They were stealing cars. They were moving drugs. So we would be involved in these groups oftentimes from the backside. They'd be doing a drug investigation and find out that they were also trying to sell stolen paintings. I mean, that happened with a Rembrandt that we recovered that was stolen from the National Museum in Stockholm. And in fact, the investigation started with a Bulgarian drug dealer in Los Angeles and led us all the way to Stockholm and then Copenhagen, where we did the undercover there to recover this $35 million Rembrandt, which had been stolen at gunpoint. So the way that occurred, these individuals went into the National Museum with machine guns, put everybody on the floor, stole three paintings for $42 million. And then basically, over a course of 5 years, we were able to recover those paintings. Ultimately, the big one was the Rembrandt. We did that undercover in Copenhagen, Denmark. I ended up working in more than 20 countries, recovering these paintings. But again, as you say, that the danger, you know, these individuals were carrying machine guns. So these armed robbery gangs, they're very good criminals. All right, they know how to do an operation, but in the end, they're terrible businessmen because they don't realize that they can't sell the artwork. So the real art in an art heist is the selling; it's not the stealing.
Because if you've got a painting like The Swing by Goya, which even a Luddite like myself knows that one, or if you've got a Rembrandt or you've got a Bruegel in the briefcase you're hocking around Madrid with, people are going to know what that is. And so presumably you have to have a pretty sophisticated network of people who, A, want to buy it, and B, who know they can never really sell it. I mean, you can't say, you can't suddenly say The Swing's gone missing and then suddenly, you know, a corporation in China has it hanging on the boardroom wall. It's going to raise some questions, isn't it, Robert?
Yes, I mean, that's the problem. You can steal it, but you can't sell it. And ultimately, if you're catching the drift of this conversation, we're talking about undercover operations executed by the FBI and the National Police Forces. And so in the end, what are they doing? They're trying to sell it, but they're selling it to the police. So, because no one's going to come up and pay. That case in Madrid, they wanted $10 million for those paintings. They were worth $65. It's a good deal if you're legit. But you're not. And so in the end, nobody's going to pay $10 million. That Rembrandt, they wanted $250,000 in U.S. dollars. Nobody's going to pay $250,000 for a stolen artwork that's worth basically nothing. You see, to be able to sell something, an artwork, you have to have, it's a three-legged stool. You need authenticity, you need provenance, and you need good title. And when you steal an object, you have no title. So you're buying nothing. And in the end, you know, it's going to get recovered. It's going to get returned. And that's when we recover almost everything. It's when it comes back to market.
Are there cases, though, of people wanting things and not being able to get them. So getting them still into order, because that seems to be or maybe I'm reading too many comic books, as we referred to a bit earlier. But is that actually a thing? Will unscrupulous individuals who just want to have it hanging in their vault in Vladivostok, or their bunker in Belarus, are they going to want to have that Van Gogh or to have that Kandinsky hanging in the hanging so only they and their friends, their cronies can appreciate it?
It's funny. There's two things to that. That whole theory was created in the early 1960s. And it was a James Bond, the first James Bond movie, Dr. No. So at one point, James Bond walks into Dr. No's caverns and he sees a Goya on an easel as he goes up some steps. And as it turned out, that Goya was stolen the year before in London. And it really was stolen, it was missing. And it was kind of put in there by the producers, tongue in cheek. And he looks at it like, oh, I wondered where that went, and kept going, right, to go catch the criminal. So ever since then, there's this Dr. No theory that these rich criminals are hiding these paintings in their basements. And the truth is, that's not what I've ever seen. I've never seen anyone anyone doing that. In fact, when we talk about these, like the Russian oligarchs that are buying art, I mean, right now I'm involved in one case involving a Russian oligarch suing Sotheby's for being defrauded after he bought $1 billion worth of art. So as you can see, he paid top dollar with the idea of owning it legally and then was defrauded. Mm-hmm. So they're victims of that as well. That's the biggest problem in today's art market. It's really not theft as much as it is frauds, forgeries, and fakes. That's probably 75% of all the art crime that's going on in the world today is frauds, forgeries, and fakes. So you have to be very, very careful when you buy something that you get the real thing and it's not a fake.
Well, that's one of the things, because, I'm sitting here in Spain, the country that produced, as we said, Goya, Velázquez, El Greco, Picasso, and, of course, Dali. And Salvador had a couple of neat tricks up his sleeve. One of them was he used to sign blank canvases and let his workshop do the rest of them. So to get the provenance of a Dali must be a detective work in itself.
Well, the only way you can buy a Dali today, really, the general theory, and I'm not speaking out of school, is you don't want to buy anything that was post-1980. Before 1980, you might be fairly safe as far as authenticity is concerned. You can't sell a Dali through the major auction houses unless you have it authenticated. It's got to be authenticated by individuals in France and Paris. So, unless you have a provenance on a piece, it's unique and authentic, it's difficult. And that's affected his market as well. I mean, the prices have gone down for these pieces because of the fact that there's so many pieces out there that are not legitimate, that are not really pieces done by Dali. So, yeah, all of the, even Miro, Picasso, they've all had that problem where there are a lot of people who've been knocking off their prints and selling them and numbering them. The whole problem with that is the authenticity of numbered prints. And so, once you get, once you can copy one of those and make a frame for it, and you put a pencil in a number and a signature, all of a sudden, you have a fairly valuable artwork. Well, that's what the fakes are doing. The fakers are doing.
You mentioned that you've worked overseas with agencies, obviously from the FBI and yourself. You take this very seriously. You've become, quote unquote, a living legend. Nice to meet you. A living legend in the business. How seriously do other countries take the theft of their artworks? The Swedes, for example, or just having their galleries ransacked basically by machine gun wielding thugs. I mean, how seriously? Because some people say, oh, it's just, it's one of those, it's not a real, nobody really gets hurt. In this case, they could have got hurt. So how seriously and how emotionally do the national police agencies get involved with art theft, considering everything else that's going on in the world at the moment?
Well, they take it very seriously because two reasons. First, because it's cultural heritage. It's the heritage of the civilized world. So when we go after looted artifacts from tombs that are dug, illegally, where there's no archaeological information given, we lose a lot of precious information from our history. When a Rembrandt's stolen, that's not just owned by the Swedish National Museum. Yes, they have legal title, but that affects all of us. That means that all of us cannot enjoy that, cannot look at that painting, and cannot see history from the 1620s. So when our cultural heritage is stolen, we lose a piece of our history and ourselves. And so that's why, that's one reason it's important. It's important to police agencies around the world because, you know, remember, you might remember when the monk, the screams were stolen. And a worldwide uproar about what happened there. So there's a lot of pressure put on the local police departments and the national police in those countries to recover their national heritage. So that becomes important. When the Rembrandt was stolen, the Swedish National Police were brought in. Now, in that case, we ended up doing it in Copenhagen. So we were working with the Danish National Police. So we had the Swedes, the Danes, and the United States all involved in recovering this piece of property, basically, a Rembrandt. And why would we do that? Because it's important to all of us. Think about it. We wouldn't have done it for a Chevrolet, for a car, you know? We wouldn't have done it for a Mercedes. We did it for a Rembrandt. Three nations coming together, putting their resources together to recover this piece of cultural heritage.
I've got to ask you this question. When you recover, when you get a Bruegel in a briefcase, which I'm going to say, obviously, this is going to stick with me, the Bruegel in the briefcase, but when you get the Goya and you're standing and you are not in a gallery, but standing in a room looking at a piece of artwork like the swing or looking at a Bruegel. I mean, it is, those are works of art documents that have so much provenance, so much history. What's it actually like when you recover a piece like that and you look at it? It's just literally almost an intimate experience with the artwork.
Well, there's two things. Maybe two or three things. First, you know, these things don't happen in a day. Sometimes these cases might take 6 months to a year to come to fruition. And that's your target as a law enforcement officer, as anybody. That's your target, is to recover this piece. Sometimes catch the criminals, depends on the situation, but recover the object. So when you first get it back, there's that moment of eureka. And you feel like, oh my goodness, your feet aren't going to touch the ground. You know, you're not going to walk around for a day, you know, with that feeling. It's almost like when I had my children and they came out and they were healthy and they were doing well. They had all 10 fingers and 10 toes. You know, for that, I was walking around on the clouds for a week. Now, with the artwork, it might be for an hour, okay, but for a week with that. But so that's the first thing. The second thing is there's a certain amount of fear for the artwork. Because usually in those situations where I'm undercover, there's going to be a SWAT team or somebody coming in to effect the arrest. So just to say, like with the Bruegel, with that particular piece, when the Spanish National Police SWAT team came into the room, I dived under a bed and held that Bruegel underneath me so that it wouldn't be damaged in any way. And of course, myself as well. With the Rembrandt, I was hiding in the bathroom in the hotel room with the Rembrandt, so that wouldn't be damaged. So there's always that thought for a moment or two that this could become, you know, a problem violently. So you always try to protect the artwork. And then, believe it or not, there's a third thing. And that's, like I said, after about a year of doing these investigations and chasing this material, believe it or not, there's a letdown. There's a moment where it's almost as if, well, that's done. You know, now we have to start all over again on the next one. And what are we going to do now? And so there's a moment of letdown when the prize is obtained, because you know, you're so featured or you're so focused on catching this tiger by the tail that when you finally catch him, you know, it's almost like that one's over. We have to start over again.
It's great you put this down in the book, Priceless. What was it like going through all the files and reliving some of those experiences?
It was a lot of fun. Because I had done all these cases, see, I only talk about things I actually did. I don't talk about, I'm not a journalist. I don't write about other people's cases. So everything you read in Crisis, I was there. Okay, one way or the other. I was there. So it wasn't so hard to go through the cases on files. It was mostly because I remembered them. And what you'll see in Crisis is the backstory. You'll see what really happened, what's not in the newspapers. You'll see how it really felt to get involved in these cases and how I got to that point where I was running around the world doing that for the FBI for close to 10 years undercover.
The book is called Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. It's by Robert K. Whitman, who we've been speaking to today. Robert, if people want to follow you, is there a website? Do you do social media? Can they keep up to date with you in any of those forms?
Sure. I have a website, www.robertwhitmaninc.com. There's also Robert Whitman Inc. at Live. That's my email, live.com. So if anyone has any questions, or if they want to send me a text or an email, or send me an email or something, I'm happy to respond. I don't speak Spanish, so you're going to have to do it in English. Okay, I just ask you that. Priceless is a New York Times bestseller. It's been published now, I think, in 15 countries. So you can pick it up. Well, you pick it up in French and German. Unbelievably, it's not in Spanish.
I know. But yeah. but luckily, we're the largest English language station, so we should be okay with that. If I've taken one thing from this interview, one image that will stay with me, Robert, it's you diving under the bed with a Bruegel whilst there was a Rembrandt in the bathroom. I mean, if that's not the top of your game, I don't know what is.
Rembrandt, I was actually in the tub in the bathroom. Because I used to teach the undercover school at the FBI headquarters in Quantico, at their schools, and I would tell the new agents who wanted to be undercover agents, the best place to hide in the bathroom is in the tub, because then you have some cover in case bullets start flying. So that's always the best spot. Hopefully it's going to be dry.
You see, they never told me that in art history classes, but there you go. This book is called Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. It's by Robert Whitman. Robert, thank you so much for your time today.
Giles, great talking to you.